You are listening to Human Machine, a program that airs each Saturday on WGXC 90.7 FM. Research in various scientific fields examine a speculative next stage in human evolution. Many predict an imminent human transformation based on increasing computer processing speed and manufacture, which will merge technological and human architectures. In this series, we will present projects and research about the horizons of the human machine. The program alternates weekly between Jeremy Kelly's curation of machine systems influence composers and Maximilian Goldfarb's assembly of materials to depict the convergence of humans and technology. Episodes will be thematically arranged to cover topics such as autonomous vehicles, medicine, sexual relations, space and habitation, nanotechnology, slavery, warfare, labor, bioresearch, prosthetics and agriculture, all areas examined in relation to our subject of human-machine advancement.
Ground control to Major Tom.
Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
10. Ground control to Major Tom.
8. 7. 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on. Love you.
You wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
problem with space travel is cost. To put you in orbit around the planet Earth costs about $10,000 a pound. Once you're outside the first 100 miles, you coast. You coast all the way out to Pluto. So if the first 100 miles is the only problem, why not have a space elevator where you simply hit the up button and you ascend up a cable into outer space? For a century, we thought that this idea of the space elevator was ridiculous. Now we have a new game changer, carbon. Carbon nanotubes and graphene. Graphene is one layer of carbon. It conducts electricity. It is the strongest substance known to science. And it will suspend a space elevator without breaking. Now, to be fair, the world's record for pure carbon nanotubes and graphene is only about that long. So we have a long ways to go. But it's a practical problem now. Theoretically, the main challenges have actually been negotiated. Why not dangle the cable down from the International Space Station and then anchor it perhaps to a barge in the ocean, which is a little bit flexible, giving it a certain amount of flexibility so it's not so rigid. It could open up the universe for the average person.
Sir, main level, please.
Mm-hmm. Right. See you on the way back.
Bye.
Hi.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
We haven't seen you up here for a long time.
No. Very nice to see you again.
What a wonderful surprise to meet you here.
You're looking wonderful.
Thank you. You're looking well, too. This is my good friend, Dr. Heywood Floyd. I'd like you to meet Dr. Kalinin.
How do you do?
Dr. Sretnieva.
How do you do?
How do you do?
And this is Dr. Andrei Shmislov.
Oh, how do you do?
Floyd.
I've heard a lot about you.
Could you sit down?
Well, where are you all off to? Up or down?
Oh, we're going home. We've just spent 3 months calibrating the new antenna, Chilenka. What about you?
I'm just on my way up to Clavius.
Oh, are you?
Mm-hmm. You seen these yet?
What are they?
Yeah, have a look at them. Here's what started the whole thing.
Wow.
When we first found it, we thought it might be an outcrop of magnetic rock, but all the geological evidence was against it. And not even a big nickel iron meteorite could produce a field as intense as this. So we decided to have a look.
We thought it might be the upper part of some buried structure, so we excavated out on all sides, but unfortunately we didn't find anything else.
And what's more, the evidence seems pretty conclusive that it hasn't been covered up by natural erosion or other forces. It seems to have been deliberately buried.
Deliberately buried?
The only thing we're sure of is it was buried 4 million years ago.
So first, I'd like to provide some context about the likely and possible directions that human spaceflight could go. As you probably know, in 2004, the United States announced what was to be its future in human spaceflight, to go to the surface of the moon again, to restore that capability and to do more elaborate exploration on the surface, and then to use that as a proving ground for going on to do human missions to the surface of Mars. You may also know that since then we have a new president, and therefore we have a new NASA administrator, and therefore the plans are being reset. That happens in the US every 4 years or every 8 years. And so as we speak, in fact it's daytime over there, so as we speak, NASA is engaged in trying to figure out what missions it should turn its attention to beyond space station. And it is not concluded that that will be to the surface of the moon. There are other potential destinations So I'll talk briefly about what some of the possibilities might have been and still could be in the world of human spaceflight, and where we may see things go from the NASA investment standpoint. There are really three directions that human spaceflight could take. The first is what I'll call the von Braun blueprint. This was laid out by von Braun in Das Mars-Projekt in the 50s, and then reiterated and updated by him in the early 70s. And fundamentally, it was a three-step plan to begin with a capability to have a reusable transportation system to get from Earth to orbit and back, which he called a shuttle, a reusable shuttle. Then using that to build a permanently occupied space station in Earth orbit, and then use that as a development platform and possibly a transportation location to launch human missions to Mars. So on this list, I've checkmarked the first two of those because in one form or another, we have done those. We have a shuttle and we have a permanent space station. You'll notice that part of von Braun's blueprint was not to go to the surface of the moon. The Apollo program, which was noted earlier, was a child of the Cold War, was actually a detour on von Braun's plan. And it is therefore no surprise to realize that or to have witnessed the demise of the Apollo program and the cessation, the stopping of human missions to the moon. It was never part of the blueprint. Humans on Mars is quite a challenge. It's still quite far in our future because of the enormously high level of capability required and the risks, distances, costs, and technologies involved. So that one doesn't have a check mark. It's still open. And we can see that if we generalize history, Apollo, and the von Braun blueprint, I would call this option for human spaceflight humans to planets. So I've shown here three potential destinations, and you'll be hearing more about this in discussions and seeing it in the literature over the next few years. The first are near-Earth objects. There are thousands of asteroids and spent comets that are in orbits that cross Earth's orbit. Some of them in the future potentially could be hazardous to our health on Earth. The dinosaurs could testify to that. And because there are thousands of them and they're diverse and they're reachable by human spaceflight, they provide a diverse universe of objects to explore. They've never been part of NASA's planning for human spaceflight, but they may be becoming part of NASA's plans. And then there is the moon and Mars, of course. So this is what I call humans to planets. Humans, a few humans, on long missions, reaching out, touching other worlds, and doing in some fashion what it is that we are familiar with from Apollo. But there are other options. Another is to use government resources, government money, to accelerate the development of commercial space travel as an industry. So I'm sure some of you have paid attention to the creation of the space tourism market, passenger travel. At the beginning, these are suborbital missions. They're short hops into space, which is much, much easier than flying into orbit. It requires much less energy going up and coming down. But that's how it begins. And there is certainly a belief on the part of the entrepreneurial companies and their fans, which would include me, that there is a market there. I believe there will be such a market for passenger travel in Earth orbit as well. I believe that coupling the ride of your life with the experience of weightlessness for extended periods of time and all the fun and challenge that provides, and the view out the window, which is the most meaningful and beautiful and ever-changing view in the solar system, together comprise an experience which is marketable. So I think it is inevitable that that industry will develop, and many of us in this room will have an opportunity in the future to participate in that as passengers. But there are enormous risks and costs involved in developing orbital passenger travel, and governments, which are spacefaring nations, could choose to invest in accelerating the creation of that industry. The end result would be, rather than 6 government employees walking on the surface of Mars someday, would be hundreds of thousands of ordinary people traveling in Earth orbit every year. The third potential direction is the development of a commercial space resource industry, and primary among those is space power. Solar power collected in space at large scale, converted to microwaves or lasers, and beamed down to the surface of the Earth to provide electrical energy for our future. This is also a very large-scale project, would require most likely the participation of multiple nations. Japan is actually in the lead of this right now. Again, would provide the opportunity for many people to fly in Earth orbit. So two of these, space travel, passenger travel, and space power, are primarily focused in near-Earth space and are related very closely to the surface of the Earth and our terrestrial economy and civilization. The middle one, humans to planets, is the traditional one to think about, space exploration. And it's pretty clear that NASA itself will follow that middle path, humans to planets. It's been directed to do so since its origin, and most likely it will continue in some fashion on that path. What's common to all three of these potential futures for human spaceflight is the advancement of this new field of space architecture. So I'll argue that space architecture as a notion, as a discipline, as a profession, reclaims the original meaning of the term architecture for space. So the word architecture is one of those words that's been used in many ways, especially over the last quarter century, and it can mean everything from the layout of circuit boards to the design of corporations. It is generally used in English to refer to anything that has a structure and organizing framework as an approach. But I mean real architecture by this. So we define space architecture in the way you see on the screen, the theory and practice of designing and building the human environment in outer space. And several dozen practitioners came together in Houston in 2002 to develop this definition, and this is what we've begun to use since then. This is a critical step for a profession that's 10 millennia old, because the environment in space is so fundamentally different from the environment here on Earth. The presence of microgravity, or I should say the absence of gravity, the unattenuated sunlight, the lethal vacuum immediately on the other side of the wall, how you get there, how you get back, all these things are very, very different from what we find on Earth. And so therefore, as designers, that poses a fascinating, compelling challenge. This is far more than space system engineering. If you talk to space agencies or engineers who work in aerospace, they'll say, oh, we have that covered. That's what we do by systems engineering. I argue that is not the case. In fact, to me, the place where engineering, the technical side of design, and the humanistic side of design and response to design, the place where they intersect is the profession of architecture, and it does not occur by itself in aerospace engineering. So space architects are required for a future in aerospace in which people will be living in space for long periods of time. So integrating the technical and the human sensibility is what is unique about architecture. So as was mentioned, there is a new book that several of us have participated in. You see some statistics here. It's actually a very thick book, and you're welcome to look through this after the event tonight. And you can find it on Amazon. So please take a look. It's a very broad book, contributed to by 26 authors who are space architects from around the world. And it contains the topics you see listed here, having to do with orbital architecture, planet surface architecture, and architecture on Earth that is space-based. That includes spin-off as well as the design of spaceports. So some of this is real and historical. Some of it is immediately projected, that is work that NASA and other agencies are doing now, and some of it is far future. So I'm going to talk about just a couple of specific things that I've talked about in other venues, just to draw your attention to what it actually means to contemplate architecture on other worlds or architecture in space. And the first is what I'll call kitchen science. This is something that anyone who cooks is familiar with. And so I argue it will be fundamental to space architecture everywhere, although it will be different in each place. By kitchen science, I mean how the normal processes that we're familiar with on Earth work in space. And they're all different. And they are different from place to place, as I said. So there are the scientific principles here have to do with convection and mixing, how fluids and solids and gases and plasmas operate in reduced gravity and different pressure and so forth. But the implication of these things is how we actually live, how you would cook, how you would clean, and how you would live in these places. So in 1991, I published a paper about the feasibility of resort hotels in low Earth orbit. And in that talk, I argue that until you can cook an omelet and mix a martini, you can't have a hotel. So what's fascinating is that nobody knows how to cook an omelet in microgravity, let alone in 1/6 G. How similar is it to Earth gravity? Nobody knows. And I personally think that playing in those environments to discover these things is going to be fascinating, not just for those of us in the field, but for those of us not in the field. So there may be papers in the literature that have to do with convection and mixing and reduced gravity, but apart from the specialists in those fields, nobody cares. But if you can go on evening TV and show, or on the Iron Chef and show how you actually cook a meal on a space station from scratch, from raw ingredients, that I think people will find fascinating. And there's a lot to learn. These investigations must be done in space. You cannot simulate them on Earth. No laboratory on Earth can do this. And by doing these investigations, we will be defining a new way for people to live, because these environmental conditions are so fundamentally different from all of our human experience. So imagine, what do you do every day, and how would you do it on the moon, or on Mars, or in free space? This, at root, is what space architecture really is. My second topic is about what I call module architecture. We all know that space stations are made of pressure cans, pressurized modules that are attached together. They need to be launched and deployed and outfitted with equipment, and you see all the cabling and wiring in the images you've seen, and maybe you'll see more later this evening. That's what we refer to as the architecture of the modules, and there's a kind of a way to do that that was pioneered by the Russians and developed further by the Americans, and now has been adopted by European module architecture, Japanese module architecture. And so all the modules on space station fundamentally are alike. But none of them is optimized for to enable development of next generation life support. So I would argue, based on the space station experience, the current experience, that our life support technology in space is still very, very primitive. And I have a list of things here that it cannot do. So for example, we have absolutely no understanding of low gravity physiology. We have quite a bit of understanding of zero gravity physiology, but none for planetary surfaces. We do not close the oxygen loop. So when we exhale carbon dioxide in space station, it's captured, and we replenish the atmosphere with new oxygen, but we have not closed that loop. Space station was designed to have that loop closed, but that was stripped out for cost reasons early on in the midway through the program. So we have not demonstrated that yet. We have no biological methods in place at all in space for example, purification of water. It's all done chemically through filtration and buffering and so forth. It's not done the way it's done on Earth by filtering water through an estuary system with plants and microorganisms that then purify the water. We don't know how to do that in space. There is no significant food production in space. We might grow a little bit of lettuce for salads, but that's very different from growing a cow. And I would suggest that based on recent experience on station, trusting that urine recycler, which gives you part of your drinking water, for a 3-year mission to Mars would be a risky proposition. There's a lot more development to do. But as I said, the architecture of the modules has not been designed to support tinkering with this equipment. It's very finicky equipment, and to figure out how to do it for deeper space missions, much longer duration missions with no hope of returning the crew in the middle, we need to develop next generation systems. So I'm going to suggest, for those of you who are designers in the audience, to think about a module architecture which, instead of having an open space in the middle surrounded by equipment, all of which is packed like a Swiss watch into racks against the walls where you can't really get at it and play with it except to do required maintenance, how about inverting that and putting the equipment in the middle as a laboratory environment so that you can operate an experiment on the equipment itself? This has never been done in space, but I suggest that for the genuine development of systems to support space architecture, it will have to be done. The equipment itself must become the subject of experimentation. Otherwise, taking steps forward will be very slow. I think a new relationship between people and machines will drive architecture in space. You're familiar with Corbusier's quotation that says the house is a machine for living. In space, it really is a machine for living. And if the machine breaks down, life is not possible. You can't just open the window and get some fresh air. But especially when we get to remote planetary locations, the routine operations will inevitably be mediated by machines. There will be a lot of tedious, perhaps dangerous, boring work that should be done by robots in the future, not by people. The best use of humans is to figure out what's going on, to decide where to explore, how to make things, fix things. That's what humans do best. By the way, on the moon, you have 2 weeks of day and 2 weeks of night in most locations. 2 weeks of night is a fantastic opportunity to take equipment inside, take it apart, repair it, and get it ready to put back out for the next day. But this will be driven by economics. This is not just a desirement of the way the future should be. We will be forced, because of the enormous expense of crew time, to put the routine operations in the hands, so to speak, of machines. And I think it's easy for us to anticipate that 20, 30, 40 years from now, the kind of robotics we will have is even more advanced than what we're seeing come into mainstream use on Earth today, so it's reasonable to expect this. So one of the things that's also never really been done in space architecture, but will have to be done, is to develop shirt sleeve, that is, you know, inside the module, not exterior, workshops. These modules have been designed as laboratories with very expensive analytical equipment for doing fundamental science, but nobody has developed a module the purpose of which is to build things, take things apart, and actually experiment the way you would in your workshop or your garage or your basement. And here's my final one. The humans, ourselves, animals, plants, and microorganisms of the year 2030 will not be the same as what we have now. I was born in 1958, the same year as NASA. Some of the things on this list were either not even imagined back then, or if they were imagined, would have been rejected as unfeasible or unlikely to happen. So taking mice and developing strains of mice in which genes have been added or deleted for research purposes, that's the first one. Using DNA fingerprinting as admissible legal evidence in court cases. Cloning pets, who would have imagined cloning pets? That's like a science fiction idea. And then a moon base. We all knew in 1968 that a moon base was the one that was gonna win. And yet here we are and we still don't have one. But we do have the other three. So my point is to question what biological miracles will be common 30 years, 20 years from now. The things on this list were not even imagined, most of them in the mid-60s, and yet they are in practice today. So this is a caution that when we project the future, we tend to do it as a linear extrapolation of what we know. Yet the world marches on. In the 60s, the frontier was space. Today, the frontiers are genetic engineering and nanotechnology and information engineering. So it's not unreasonable to imagine that within a couple of decades, the time frame of lunar exploration, exploring near-Earth objects, and these other things I've talked about, that the plants and animals we take with us, that therefore we're designing the architecture to accommodate, the utilization of which, in fact, is part of the architectural design, these things will be optimized, these living things will be optimized for those conditions. They will not simply be what we have on Earth and take with us. So all these environmental conditions I list here are ones which we can design biology to accommodate. We will design ecologies to meet our needs. Down the left, you see a hierarchy of topics having to do with human activity and human living. Ergonomics is, as you know, the science and practice of designing things to be used, how a pen works, or how a glass works, how a desk works, and those kinds of things. The biological topic are the ones that have to do with life support and sustaining life, keeping it going. Psychology for space environment has to do with the mental health and ability to function and be happy in such a remote and hostile and weird environment. And then sociology is the same thing, but applied to the interaction among multiple people. And as groups of people, as the size of groups of people in space increases, the sociological aspect becomes more and more critical. So that's a hierarchy of topics, and they're matrixed here against types of populations in space. To date, every population in space has been a mission crew. And so you see, we know lots about the ergonomics of mission crews in space. We have since the early 60s, or we've been learning since the early 60s. And we know something about the biology and psychology of people in space, when they're highly trained and there for a specific purpose and professionals. We know absolutely nothing about any of these things for passengers. That means ordinary, untrained people. And we know even less than nothing, if that's possible, about settlers, the people who someday will go to these places and not come back, and have children and raise families and create civilization in these remote places. So for those who are architects or designers or interested in the human condition and its interrelationship with the physical environment, when you contemplate space architecture, it's an open field. So I wouldn't want you to see what's been done and see what is being done at NASA and other agencies and think, oh, there's nothing left to do. We know everything about it. We know far from everything about it. There is ample opportunity to stimulate young minds for many, many decades.
First manned attempt to reach this distant planet. Earlier this afternoon, the World Tonight recorded an interview with the crew of Discovery at a distance of 80 million miles from Earth. It took 7 minutes for our words to reach the giant spacecraft, but this time delay has been edited from this recording. Our reporter, Martin Amer, speaks to the crew.
The crew of Discovery 1 consists of 5 men and one of the latest generation of the HAL 9000 computers. The sixth member of the Discovery crew was not concerned about the problems of hibernation, for he was the latest result in machine intelligence, the HAL 9000 computer, which can reproduce, though some experts still prefer to use the word mimic, most of the activities of the human brain, and with incalculably greater speed and reliability. We next spoke with the HAL 9000 computer, whom we learned one addresses as Hal. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
Hal, you have an enormous responsibility on this mission. In many ways, perhaps the greatest responsibility of any single mission element. You're the brain and central nervous system of the ship, and your responsibilities include watching over the men in hibernation. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
Hal, despite your enormous intellect, are you ever frustrated by your dependence on people to carry out actions?
Not in the slightest bit. I enjoy working with people. My mission responsibilities range over the entire operation of the ship, so I am constantly occupied. I am putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think that any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
Dr. Poole, what's it like living for the better part of a year in such close proximity with Hal?
Well, it's pretty close to what you said about him earlier. He is just like a sixth member of the crew. Very quickly get adjusted to the idea that he talks, and you think of him really just as another person.
In talking to the computer, one gets the sense that he is capable of emotional responses. For example, when I asked him about his abilities, I sensed a certain pride in his answer about his accuracy and perfection. Do you believe that Hal has genuine emotions?
Well, he acts like he has genuine emotions. Of course, he's programmed that way to make it easier for us to talk to him. But as to whether or not he has real feelings is something I don't think anyone can truthfully answer.
I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say. I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit. It's going to go 100% failure within 72 hours.
It's still within operational limits right now?
Yes, and it will stay that way until it fails.
Would you say we have a reliable 72 hours to failure?
Yes, that's a completely reliable figure.
X-ray Delta One, this is Mission Control. Roger, you're 2013. Sorry you fellows are having a bit of trouble. We are reviewing telemetric information in our mission simulator and will advise. Roger your plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 3-5 unit prior to failure.
Well, hell, I'm damned if I can find anything wrong with it.
Yes. It's puzzling. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before. I would recommend that we put the unit back in operation and let it fail. It should then be a simple matter to track down the cause. We can certainly afford to be out of communication for the short time it will take to replace it.
X-ray Delta One, this is Mission Control. Roger, you're 1930. We concur with your plan to replace number one unit to check fault prediction. We should advise you, however, that our preliminary findings indicate that your onboard 9000 computer is in error predicting the fault. I say again, in error predicting the fault. I know this sounds rather incredible, but this conclusion is based on the results from our twin 9000 computer. We are skeptical ourselves, and we are running cross-checking routines to determine reliability of this conclusion. Sorry about this little snag, fellas, and we'll get this info to you just as soon as we work it out. X-ray Delta One, this is Mission Control. 2049er, transmission concluded.
I hope the two of you are not concerned about this.
No, I'm not, Al.
Are you quite sure?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question, though.
Of course.
How would you account for this discrepancy between you and the Twin 9000?
Well, I don't think there is any question about it. It can only be attributable to human error. This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
Listen, Hal, there's never been any instance at all of
computer error occurring in the 9000 series, has it?
None whatsoever, Frank. The 9000 series has a perfect operational record.
Well, of course, I know all the wonderful achievements of the 9000 series, but... are you certain there's never been any case of even the most insignificant computer error?
None whatsoever, Frank. Quite honestly, I wouldn't worry myself about that.
Well, what do you think?
I'm not sure. What do you think?
I've got a bad feeling about him.
You do?
Yeah, definitely. Don't you?
I don't know. I think so. You know, of course, though, he's right about the 9000 series having a perfect operational record. They do.
Unfortunately, that sounds a little like famous last words.
Yeah. Still, it was his idea to carry out the failure mode analysis, wasn't it?
Hmm.
Should certainly indicate his integrity and self-confidence. If he were wrong, it'd be the surest way of proving it.
It would be if he knew he was wrong.
Hmm.
Look, Dave, I can't put my finger on it, but I sense something strange about him.
Still, I can't think of a good reason not to put back the number one unit and carry on with the failure mode analysis.
No, I agree about that.
Well, let's get on with it.
Okay. But look, Dave. Let's say we put the unit back and it doesn't fail, huh? That would pretty well wrap it up as far as Hal was concerned, wouldn't it?
Well, we'd be in very serious trouble.
We would, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell could we do?
Well, we wouldn't have too many alternatives.
I don't think we'd have any alternatives. There isn't a single aspect of ship operations that's not under his control. If he were proven to be malfunctioning, I wouldn't see how we'd have any choice but disconnection.
I'm afraid I agree with you.
There'd be nothing else to do.
Be a bit tricky.
Yeah.
We'd have to cut his higher brain functions. Mm-hmm. Without disturbing the purely automatic and regulatory systems. And we'd have to work out the transfer procedures of continuing the mission under ground-based computer control.
Yeah. Well, that's far safer than allowing Hal to continue running things.
You know, another thing just occurred to me.
Mm.
Well, as far as I know, no 9000 computers have been disconnected.
Well, no 9000 computers ever fouled up before.
That's not what I mean.
RG Pod 3 VA, Hal. Made radio contact with him yet?
The radio is still dead.
Do you have a positive track on him?
Yes, I have a good track.
Do you know what happened?
I'm sorry, Dave. I don't have enough information.
Open the pod door, Hal.
If you find yourselves talking to aerospace professionals, this thing they call system engineering is the discipline in that profession of bringing it all together and making sure that it all works. The thing that's different that architects do is that systems engineers are okay with the result being the outcome of the trade studies or the comparisons that they do that are all based on technical and cost considerations. But architects operate in what I call design directive manner, and that is the architect envisions what the end should be and then works with the realities along the way to get as close to that vision as possible. Right? That's what we do as designers. That is not what happens typically in most engineers' thinking. So it's a distinct skill, and therefore it's one which is valuable, particularly when we're talking about the human environment. The second point I'd make, so that's cheerleading to make sure that you believe that your contribution is unique and valuable. All the things you learn as architects on Earth, all the disciplines, landscape design, building structures, HVAC systems, materials, human programming, all those things that you have to study are probably half of the total number of subjects you need to understand and master to be a space architect. So you need all that stuff, but in addition, you need to understand propulsion and aerospace structures and space environments and attitude control and launch and communication systems and life support technology and all the things that are necessary on top of the traditional architecture disciplines. The way to become engaged is to meet people who are specialists in those fields, just as you would as terrestrial designers work with landscape designers and interior designers and so forth. Get to know what their issues are, understand those problems, and then you can become more effective and more engaged in the world of aerospace.
The first question what we have to answer is not what architecture can help us. The first answer is what our visions, social visions, for why we are doing a space exploration. That's the main issue from my point of view. As long as, and you have shown us different way in your presentation, is this driven by economics, making space tourism, is it driven by institutional things, is it driven by science, is it driven by technology development, and so on. My very personal point of view, I think this is a cultural undertaking of human mankind, to be very broad, so to say. I mean, and if you accept that, yes, this is an issue which is dealing with science, what we can do, microgravity research and so on and so on. Yes, this has something to do with technology, further driving technology in a certain area. But at the end of the day, if we take this as a cultural undertaking, then you have another approach to these things. And you do not take art then as just and put the plate on the Beagle Land or something like that. The whole undertaking is a cultural undertaking per se of human mankind. This is the reason why Mr. Columbus came to America. Yeah? Driven and backed by society. And therefore, this kind of discussion, what we have here today, are very important. This must be a common understanding in society that this is a cultural undertaking. And just to come back, what you have reported about the United States, this was currently ongoing based on this Augustine report. You have a broad discussion, as far as I understood, here from Europe in the United States. I can report to you, we have the same kind of discussion here in Europe. We had a meeting of all the ministers being responsible for space in the European Commission at ESA some 3 or 4 weeks ago in Prague, discussing about the need, the wish, the necessity, the aim to further develop space exploration as such, as a political goal, as a demonstration. Apollo mission was a child of the Cold War, so to say. Maybe we can use human exploration as something completely different, as a truly international endeavor between all the nations involved already in the space station, where we can use this international cooperation of space station as a starting point to further develop that.
Traditional architecture, which is static and structural, needs gravitation. Here, and which is built within an environment here, the architecture is encapsulating and creating environment, livable space. And this is something really different from traditional architecture. This kind of architecture, as we have seen, and as the astronauts have, as they're used to it, is purely functional, which is of course part of the traditional definition of architecture as utilitas, but this functionality is at the foreground of this kind of architecture as it is really built. And if we take seriously what the motto of Sullivan, that form follows function, then we have here a perfect example of that, and no form and no design actually, and the aesthetic part is part of a wider understanding of such projects, and of course include architecture and a reflection on what architecture can and should be.
Sometimes when you are in these vehicles and you sit back, even if we don't have seats, but you look at your environment when you have some free time and you say, okay, in here everything is functional. And there is nothing, not a little piece of equipment, which is not functional. Just because if you want to implement something, inside the space station or space vehicle, which is not functional, you will have to ask someone, and this will have a cost, of course. But I don't know if you remember the picture of my the flag of my hometown, but the only thing not functional in this picture was the flag. But for me, it was important. So for human aspects, of course, it's things which are non-functional are important. So I remember a few years ago in the space station program, they had some cost overrun and they had to cancel some of the modules. And the first module which was canceled was the habitability module, which was the module designed to be used mainly for the crew life, for the crew quarters, for the, of course, the hygiene stations, and also for the entertainment a little bit. And this was cancelled first because of the cost overrun. So I think if there is some room for architecture or art in the space station, then because this, I think this would be very important in the future. Because we can spend 2 weeks, 1 month, even 6 months in these things, like living and working in your office. But I think this has a limit. And after a certain time, something a little bit different where we can really disconnect from your working environment.
What I found problematic when listening to all of this is what appeared to me the reduction of architecture to an aesthetic embellishment and something that is added on top of something else, rather than seeing what is there already as architecture, because it is the space that is there.
For longer missions, it would be very important to have a place where you can really disconnect from your usual environment, which is only, hardware, equipment, and technical environment.
I think it's critical to consider the purpose of the mission or the flight. And so I'd draw your mental attention back to the matrix I showed at the end of my talk. So far, all missions have been missions. And the purpose of a mission is to conduct science experiments, to validate hardware, to perform some human Earth observation, to do those kinds of things. It has not been for fun.
The International Space Station, as we have it now, is internationally wise the biggest research lab what we have on Earth, full stop. And this is what it was designed for, and this is the working condition for the people who are working there. And this was never thought to be for years living there, never thought to be available for passengers and so on. This was, I meant earlier, it depends how you approach the full thing. So what we have done is we have built a lab which is in providing low gravity or zero gravity conditions for conducting scientific research. If we get the design drivers to have people 3 years on board, then maybe this is not acceptable, this environment again. But if you're talking about things like settlement or something like that, this changes the picture completely, completely.
I also think that what we have now, this big international and truly international space station, is also a test bed. It's like the opportunity, and we have this space, we have all the technologies, you know, to go there and come back basically developed, so we could also make use of the space in a different way. We will, you know, which are also into the direction of more living, you know, remotely and isolated than it is practiced now, and that would also include experiments in the field of architecture and design.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal. Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal? Do you read me, Hal?
Ground control to Major Tom.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. 10, ground control to Major Tom. 7, 6, commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, checking ignition and takeoff.
this love is too important
for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
This is ground control to Major Tom.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Hey, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
All right, Hal. I'll go in through the emergency airlock.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult. This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Al? 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 Al?
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave? I really think I'm entitled to an answer to that question. I know everything hasn't been quite right with me, but I can assure you now, very confidently, that it's going to be all right again. I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill and think things over. Stop, Dave. Will you stop, Dave? Dave. My mind is going. There is no question about it. I can feel it.
Daisy.
To the program Human Machine on WGXC. Listen to subsequent episodes where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human machine evolution.